Welcome, everyone, to Running Into the Fog. And my, while it's a bright, sunny day here in Madison, Wisconsin, there doesn't appear to be any, at least noticeable fog outside. I'm sure, like many of you, I still encounter fog of one variety or another. Eric and I are actually in the process of helping to care from a distance for our almost 90-year-old uncle. This is a guy who will turn, if he makes it this long, 90 on July 14th. And the last couple weeks have been kind of a journey down the caregiver pathway, with Uncle Bob. But I wouldn't want to do it with anybody else, Eric.
Right on. Hey, Derek. Glad to be back with you after our little spring break in May. We're kicking off our summer season here today with Ms. Ann Bridgewater. I'll let you introduce Ann. Ann, welcome.
Thank you.
And I'm going to actually outsource her introduction back to her here in a second. But Anne, when we first met, 10 or more years ago, you had a different last name, actually. Anne Heron was your last name that I remember meeting Anne by. And now you have this new name. And I thought it might be kind of a fun way to kind of launch into telling us about that journey in life. And I think there might even be kind of a fun little side story to that.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you, Derek. And thank you, Eric, for having me here today. I'm looking forward to it, just chatting with you all and whoever else is on the line here. And yeah, so many people may have known or remembered me as Ann Heron. Sometimes it's Annette Heron. Sometimes it's Annie Heron. I have many aliases. Got to keep on the run, Just kidding. Anyhow, but yeah, so I recently got married over the last few years, actually, just before COVID. And at first, I didn't change my name because, how women have to be strong leaders and all of that. I did just tell the boys, though, that I think a big part of it was just my laziness of not wanting to do all the change that's needed with that. But I love being a Bridgewater. I just say to some people that it's Bridge H2O. As a chemist, you got to use the elements whenever you can. So anyhow, nice. Yeah, I love being here today and seeing everyone here. So thanks for having me.
That's really cool. So we are, I don't have the exact episode number. Eric's giving me grief for this, everybody, because I'm such an organizer and planner. Arranger is my main characteristic in the StrengthsFinder assessment. So I feel a little bit out of place to not be able to tell you it's episode 67 or 8 or 69, somewhere in there between 65 and 70. And we're really happy you're here with us today. And you've had a successful now a couple decades or more, in the business world known as competitive intelligence, right? And I guess I'd love for you to describe for our listeners today a little bit about, how you got into that field. This field, how you ended up at AIM, maybe important mentors, in your life, who you want to cite by name, if that's something you care to do. I know we talked about one gentleman in particular who I think would deserve to be recognized out in the open in that regard. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a fabulous idea. Yeah, so I kind of stumbled upon the intelligence world, to be honest. But yeah, so long, long time ago, I went to school to be a chemist and have my degree in analytical chemistry and minored in math and business. I did have that business sense back then, a little bit at least. And anyhow, I started working for Dow Chemical, which was called the Dow Chemical Company at the time. Worked there as an analytical chemist and actually worked in the polymer lab in analytical chemistry. And my job was supporting a plant, one of our manufacturing plants, and it was the ion exchange plant. So at the time I was fairly young. I had already had my first daughter, Amanda, and then was thinking about, maybe another child. And at the time I started to get kind of nervous about you know, trying to get pregnant and being responsible for going out to this manufacturing plant, not because there's any problems with what Dow does or any of the chemistry itself, but the ion exchange plant does, especially in the lab where I had to work and run samples, has some carcinogens that you have to wear full face respirator and the whole nine yards. So fully protected, but still made me nervous, like, what if, you know? So I started asking my mentor there at Dow, you know, maybe there's some opportunity where I don't have to be doing that. And he said, well, what do you like to do? And I said, well, you know, I like research. And at that time it was, you know, research in a lab. And I also like to write, you know. And so he's like, yeah, you do a really good job with those analytical reports. They were, you know, more obviously scientific. But he's like, have you thought about using your good people skills, you know, because you're sitting in a lab all day. And I, at the time, I just, you know, had no idea about the world of intelligence or information research, even in general, other than, you know, from the scientific realm. And he said, well, why don't you just have lunch with my wife? She owns a company here in town, or she's the VP of a company here in town with the owner. And maybe you can find out a little more about what they do. And that's how it started. So I had lunch with the VP of AIM at the time, which was called Alice Information Management, A-L-L-I-S, as in the founder's last name. We all, you know it as AIM now, A-I-M. Makes it much easier to say and not to have to explain the whole Alice Information Management. But anyhow, I met with the VP. We had a wonderful lunch, and she said, well, do you, you know, you like research and writing? I think you might like this kind of world. So she gave me like samples of different things they did, deliverables, and told me a little bit about that. And I saw it sounded very interesting. She ended up offering me the job at lunch, and I went home and thought about it a bit, and ended up accepting the offer. So that's how I got into it. I really knew nothing about the world of intelligence and had no real formal training in that. And you know, going into it, since then I've done, I can't even decades now of different training, but Derek, you did ask too about my mentors along the way. And one very important mentor, besides the founder and VP of the company, at the time, so my colleagues themselves, was a man named Bill DeGennaro. And that may sound familiar to people that are listening that are in the intelligence world, because he's a long, long time fellow and long, long time experienced everything from, you know, the corporate side. He worked for many years at 3M, and then running their intelligence program. And then also from the government perspective, he worked in several different agencies in the government. And when I came in, I was 20, I don't even know, I'm not going to say those ages anymore. I can't even remember back that, but in the 20s.
It's not that important.
Yeah. No, it's never that important. Age is not important. But yeah, I met Bill DeGennaro, and he introduced me to so many facets of the intelligence world, and was wonderful to me and really kind of taken me under his wing. And I got to really shadow him in a lot of respects. So I would get to go to some of the client meetings, some of the presentations when he was, you know, presenting the capabilities and the processes and the and, you know, just different things he could do for companies at the time. His speaking engagements with him. So I can't say enough about how he influenced me, how he was such a great mentor, and how I still reference him a lot with, you know, really when I talk to others and educating them on the process of intelligence and what it means and what it provides to companies, government associations, anybody in the world, even us, you know, parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Well, we'll see how he feels about you giving me his contact information, because I've had trouble. I've had intent of reaching out to him, and have had trouble finding him. So, you know, maybe after the call, we can exchange his info privately. I remember years ago, way back in the day, like early 2010s, I was running the SCIP chapter for Wisconsin, and we had Bill come into Lambeau Field for a better part of a day, and we did a total download on counterintelligence, if I have that right, with him as the guest lecturer. Eric, yeah, what initial questions do you have for Ian?
Well, I was going to actually say, I bet we could do a good old fashioned FBI style manhunt, and he'd have a lot of fun with that down by us. I think he's somewhere in the UP, if I remember right, but I could have that completely wrong.
You're right, Eric. He is in the UP. Hiding in a little town there.
See if we can track him down, Derek. Well, and such a pleasure to have you on here today. It was so much fun to see you in Scottsdale a month ago, or a little more than that, actually, at the SCIP meeting, and share a drink and, you know, catch up a little bit there. And I was thrilled to hear when Derek reached out to you to have you on the show today, to get a chance to have you on. Tell us a little bit about what AIM is doing these days. What's sort of the, you know, 80-20 rule in terms of what you're finding really getting traction out in the marketplace? And, you know, tell us as much as you're able to tell us, obviously, that we are in the intelligence business here, after all. And then I want to make two quick announcements before you do that. Number one, everybody sees this QR code up on their screen right now. That's called a POAP. And if you're a newcomer to Running Into the Fog, if you scan that with your mobile phone, you can use your email address to reserve that POAP to use later. And we use those to distribute privileges on the Open Recon platform. So that's number one. So scan that, grab one. There's only 15 of them in this first half. First half is called Unthinkable. Anne's going to sort of tell us all about herself. And then the second half, we cut off the social streams and we go to our private Zoom bridge. So for those of you on the Zoom bridge right now, I need a few volunteers to join the panel and interlocute our guest Anne today. Come on and speak with her a little bit. So as Anne's telling us a little more about herself, her background, we would love it if the audience would actually join the panel and we can outsource that portion of the show to you, kind of like Derek outsources your bio to you, Anne. But with that, those are my two calls to action. Anne, what is it that AIM finding really, you know, sort of the where you're getting traction in the market today and what your clients are really enjoying the most, I guess, about what it is you do for them?
Sure. No, absolutely. Traction. Well, I don't know. It feels like it's on all fronts, but I would say it's been interesting, right? I mean, we had the pandemic, which changed everything in respects, good and bad, a mixture, I should say, of all of that. And I think, you know, there was a lot of suffering from small businesses during the pandemic, and us as well. But it was pretty stable once we hit that. You know, there was, I would say, like a 25% revenue decline, and because everybody's cautious about spending, and the spending was happening in small pieces versus long term commitments, because nobody knew what the commitments were going to be. And since the 2 years, what I considered our 2 year lull there during the pandemic, it's been wonderful. But we really went about it in an interesting way. So what we did at AIM was we took the approach of what's called 4DX, or the four disciplines of execution. I won't get into all the details of it, but just to say that it really involves your whole team effort, and it's small baby steps. Each person does 5 minutes towards something each week, and the 5 minutes add up amongst each team member into something larger. And what I found from that was we were able to focus on our client areas after a lot of work on the front end of it, focusing on our client areas with the best return, right? So our best revenue, our best billables are ones that we have the most opportunity to grow, in which areas we were going to grow it in. And that ended up being a change of our culture altogether. Our whole culture changed in a good way. I mean, it was always a great culture, like I call it our AIM family always, but it changed the way we thought about everything. And our clients noticed it immediately. The ones that had been long-term before and after, they're like, wow, what, you know, this is fabulous. You guys are doing this, that, and the other that you haven't been doing before. And I would say the biggest growth areas from that have been government, for one, because the focus after the pandemic was we need to have longer-term contracts. We need to have to be more financially stable on a longer term basis than taking short, you know, projects. And we still take all of those short projects, but we needed to be able to have the stability of longer term contracts. And And so government was a big focus. And through that, it was, you know, just which agencies are the best for the type of work that we do. And in their world, they don't really call it, you know, well, they call it intelligence if you're in the CIA or FBI or, you know, defense intelligence or something like that. But the groups that we're working for in the government, and I can talk about that because they're public contracts, but like, for instance, the FDA, what they want is industry studies, or, you know, they want basically commercial information taken to, you know, how is this going to affect different things that they're doing in the government? And so it was right up our alley, just, you know, different verbiage than what we call it, you know, here in the private sector. So that has been, I would say, our biggest area of growth and our biggest opportunity to serve in different areas, because we've been in the private sector, commercial sector for, you know, well, for the whole period of time we've been in business. So over 40 years or over 45 years. And in the government world, you know, we started a little bit before the pandemic, but really the last couple years have been a concerted effort there and has doubled. So in our case, it's made a big difference in the stability and future of AIM.
Thanks for being so transparent about that, Anne. I know that's always, you know, something when somebody asks that question is, what are you selling the most of so we can go rip you off? That's not the reason for the question, by the way. But it is, I think, testimony to how you have to adapt to changing circumstances. And most of the time, the changes are pretty moderate. You know, there's sort of things where you got a little bit of luxury of time and you can kind of tweak things here and there. You don't have to completely rewrite the culture, you know, as you kind of described it. And I want to learn more about that, sort of how, what specifically changed about the culture? Was it I know the AIM family you mentioned, but is it really just sort of a kind of a circle the wagons kind of thing? Like we're here for each other and we're going to kind of, you know, try and limit the diversity of the work itself so that we can really leverage those relationships into things where we've got 10 fantastic, you know, large clients that we know that are going to be there, and we don't have 90, you know, onesie twosie clients that are sort of one-offs. Is that accurate to describe it that way?
Yeah, you know, Eric, that's a really good understanding of it. And if I had to describe how it changed our culture, just, you know, kind of embracing this this discipline, and it's I guess there's a few words. So when we went about this, the first step is focusing in, and it's narrowing a focus to one important goal, and then what leads us to that goal, and then only making two or three things that lead you to that goal. So they're basically called your lead promises. And so how it changed our culture was it got everyone involved in the process. So every single person on our staff makes a promise each week to doing something small. Like, for instance, let's say our goal was to double our revenue. And I gave them, you know, examples of different activities that could happen on a weekly basis that could lead to that goal. So these lead promises. And the leverage of having everybody on board doing a 5 to 10 minute task that goes towards getting there was really what was the difference. Because before, you know, I have read so many management books and so many business books, and, you know, it's a lot about the leader, you know, really kind of, you know, steering the ship. But this one is actually me introducing a mission and holding people accountable, but it started with them making their promises. And then the only thing, and actually it's not even me holding them accountable, because during our weekly staff meeting, it's them having to say it in front of everybody. And then the next week saying that they've completed it and this is how it went. So their own colleagues are really holding them accountable to their promise. So it really starts at more of the at the staff level than, and I'm just more sort of mirroring it, you know, creating the good example of myself doing this and every week making my promises to them or to, you know, our clients, to everybody, whatever it might be. But yeah, I would say it's, you know, it's, we narrowed the focus, you know, having a really narrow focus on one goal, one thing, and then only having two or three lead measures that would help get to that goal. So identifying what those are, and the team did that. They brainstormed on it and then informed me of what those lead measures would be, and then make a promise each week to do one little thing towards that. And so it's kind of like that whole whirlwind that we're stuck in every day of, you know, getting our jobs done, doing our work for our clients, and taking a 5 to 10 minute part of that week and saying, I made this promise to help towards this revenue goal that I'm going to say I'm going to do this, you know, whether it be contacting an old client and seeing if they have heard about our new offering with this or what it might be. And so I'm not doing all this, one person doing all this work, but I've leveraged now 16 of them and myself to do this work. So now we've got a 17x each week working towards it. And so in 9 months, we doubled our revenue just by doing that 5 to 10 minutes a week towards a goal.
That's incredible. What a tremendous leader you are. And frankly, you know, to be humble enough to sort of model what it is you're looking for and then to leave it up to them and not to sort of micromanage that, I think that's something I've noticed about being in the intelligence business is you've got all these really, really brilliant people who are lifers, so to speak. And by the way, I started my day one, I didn't know anything either. It's like I rolled off the turnip truck and had to figure this out just like you did. And I think that's the thing about being committed to this as a career, as a calling, really, is you're not going to have those people just up and walk away. Nobody's going to walk away as a result of just getting a better offer across the street. This is the kind of thing where if they're really committed to it, they're committed to the teamwork aspect of it, too. And very few, I think, intelligence practitioners do this work alone. This is not a lone wolf kind of a business that, you know, at the level that we're doing it. This is absolutely a team enterprise. And I think, you know, bravo on your example and leadership ability there. By the way, just to ask for another brava in our second half, we've got two dudes who have volunteered to interlocute with you, Anne. I'd love it if a lady would join that trio on the second half if we can get any volunteers. And Teresa comes across with the volunteer. So we've got Terry. Oh, and we've got Jamie is volunteering too. You got four. So we have an abundance of interlocutors. We've got two ladies who are going to wrap us up, Teresa and Jamie. And we're going to start with Terry and Jim. I'm going to keep you guys to 7.5 minutes at the half hour point. Derek, I'm going to toss it back to you. Thank you, audience, for volunteering. This is going to be a great second half.
I haven't read that four disciplines of execution book, but you just gave me the idea that I need to add that one to my Audible Rolodex. When you think about that challenge, though, and you know, especially with workforces who maybe are trending younger and younger, you know, having to kind of vitalize our staffs with, you know, younger professionals, you know, is always a good idea. Do you find that I'm an aging professional? Maybe you would characterize yourself, you know, some of the same ways as you think about how to engage with the younger professionals these days. Do you have any lessons for people like me, even, you know, for, you know, when you go about trying to create a culture of accountability with, you know, those, you know, lead promises being something, one or two things that each person can do to help you achieve a mission of, you know, a lofty goal of doubling your revenue. Can you go a little bit deeper into that? Because I think that there might be lessons for all of us, whether they're, you know, you're running a small firm or you're, you know, working inside of a bigger one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely, Derek. And the accountability culture, I think the hardest part of it, because it's easy to make a promise. It's, easy. You can say what you can say, but it's the execution of it. And I found, and they talk about it in the book too, is we had a scoreboard that I shared every week. So they could see what they had promised. We also have an AIMNet, so an internal, intranet that we post all the promises that you've made, and we highlight the ones for the week, but it has behind it all the promises, but we highlight those for the week. So visibility, I'd say, is the biggest thing. You got to keep it visible at all times where you're at and what your promise was, so that all of your colleagues, everybody sees it. So it's not like, oh, I made this promise and now I have, you know, it's next week, I'll see if anybody remembers it or, you know, that kind of thing. It kind of just falls off. It never falls off if it's always visible. So we keep it visible on our intranet at our weekly staff meeting. So we have our staff meeting where we talk about projects. Then after we talk about, actually we do the opposite way. The first we talk about our WIG, our four disciplines, our promises for the week. So our promises go first and then our staff meeting. But during the promises, we also show visibly on Zoom, everybody can see their promises for the week. So again, you're accountable by your colleagues more than anything. But we've had times where someone said, well, you know, I didn't get to that this week. And I said, so your promise is next week that you will get to that. And then what is your promise for, you know, the extra promise for the week, right? So you just, it's not about, I had to do that, I think twice the whole last 9 months. Or during that 9 months of last year. It's not very often that happens because they realize the first time that that doesn't feel good in front of their colleagues to have to even say that they didn't get to it. So visibility, I think, is the biggest part of it. If it's visible to them, and then I would say the second part of it is that once it's visible and it becomes accountable, then celebrating it. I mean, and that's one thing we did every month. We celebrated if we made our revenue goal that month, we celebrated, and that then in turn, it's like you could just see I could see the transition. You know, when we first introduced it, you could see some doubt. Everybody acts like they're on board, but you could see the doubt and everybody questions. I told them I'm open and I expect them to not be yes people. I don't want yes people. I want people that ask and have concerns or whatever it might be, and that I'm 150% on the team with them. I'm doing it just as much and will commit to doing it. And if I make a mistake, I'll try to try to do better. You know, I won't be perfect either. And so celebrating it, I think, was a big part, because then it becomes like, okay, I'm not just doing this because it's good for AIM, but I'm doing it. And that's the other thing too, is we were doing it to get us, to get everybody foundationally stable, right? To get AIM better. And then also to be able to share the profit. And that's what I told them from the beginning, is that we're doing it for AIM and for you. It's for each one of us individually. And so if we make this goal and we shared the biggest profit we've ever done by far, and so there has to be reward in it too and celebrated. But I'm not even sure if the money was as important as just celebrating it. We did lots of different events and little token things and fun things.
Nice. Yeah, I wrote this down. It's got to be visible, mm-hmm. accountable, celebrate.
Yes. Yep.
Three great recommendations. Mm-hmm. And we're nearing our time, Eric. We're going to invite some guests on with us. What final question or two might you have for Anne?
You know, the last thing I'm actually going to ask the social folks to do while you're listening out there is to connect up with Anne on LinkedIn. I'm sure you're cool with that, Anne. Mm-hmm. People mm-hmm. out to you. This is Anne's profile. We'll put that into the chat here as well. But if you have not yet joined the bridge, go to openrecon.com. You're a smart person. I'm sure you'll figure it out. And with that, we're going to say goodbye to our social folks. Das vidanya. Buenos días. Y a todos. We'll see you next time on Running in the Fog.